You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM. Melting Pot is the name of the show, and I am just ecstatic to welcome in our guest today. DJ Spinner is here in our studios. How are you doing, man?
I'm good.
It really is just a great pleasure. I think of you as, you know, you're one of my favorite DJs, a real kind of DJ, though there's so many other things that you do as well. And again, it's just really an honor to have you in our studios.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
And one of the things that I we're going to talk a lot about, you know, your career and you know, what you have going on music wise. But I know you're from Brooklyn and live in Brooklyn. And I was wondering if you could just tell us how things are going in Brooklyn, especially since Hurricane Sandy.
Well, you know, we were pretty lucky compared to other areas of New York City. Queens, Far Rockaway, Queens got it really bad. They still don't have lights over there, power in certain parts, especially in the, you know, where the Far Rockaway projects are located. They're still, you know, it seems like they're being neglected as well. And as well, in Brooklyn, we have a section called Red Hook, and they're also... some parts are still underwater, and not definitely not as bad as like Jersey and Queens, but you know, some basements flooded over there because it's near the water.
Yeah,
and they're also out of power. And we were starting to recover, and then we got hit with another blizzard, a nor'easter, this past Wednesday. So, you know, kind of set things back a little bit, but you know, Brooklyn overall is not as bad as other places. You know, like I said, Staten Island has got hit really bad. Queens, Long Island, and Jersey. Whew, man, really bad out there. You know?
Yeah, it's you know, I'm from the South originally, and so I'm familiar with the kind of damage that hurricanes can do. I think a lot of times people out on the West Coast, because, you know, West Coast, the worst they get are earthquakes, and it's, you know, I mean, there hasn't been a big one in years and years, but hurricane damage is pretty, you know, yearly, even though this one is a really extraordinary storm. But I wanted to make sure that we kind of checked in and just to see how things were doing, and just because it seems like there's a lot of coverage, but not always coverage of every single community, it seems.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, even driving around in my neighborhood, Clinton Hills, Fort Greene, and, you know, extended family members, close family members as well, you know, I know that there's been a lot of downed trees, you know, trees falling on power lines, and some fires as a result of that. And right down the block from my studio, actually, I saw a huge tree fall on an SUV and crashed through the windshield. You know what I mean? So it's a lot of damage has been done, you know, but as far as like severity, deaths, and, you know, there's one area in Queens where pretty much a whole neighborhood was wiped out. You know, 100 houses burned down. People are homeless, and yeah, this definitely caused a lot of destruction. Man, it's unbelievable that on the East Coast, especially tri-state, we would experience something like this. You know, definitely is an indication of how things are changing in the world.
Yeah.
You know, especially with climate and weather and what have you. I mean, we had a minor earthquake last year, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't feel anything. I was actually sleeping at the time when it happened. But I know people that did feel it, and it definitely freaked people out, you know, what they weren't ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah, these are kind of strange times, it seems, that we live in, but it is nice in terms of the response. More so, especially, you know, just kind of like the human response to these kind of tragedies and how it brings people together. And, you know, there are a lot of people out here in Los Angeles on the West Coast, certainly have family out there and a lot of friends. And so, you know, we're constantly thinking about y'all.
Yeah, it's definitely a testament to the humankind and how we can actually pull together and look out for each other, because, you know, we're lucky, you know, as a human race. I think in some parts of the world, you know, they probably wouldn't be as lucky. The relief efforts and, you know, the drive to raise funds all over the country has been stepped up. So, you know, it's definitely unifying and making you realize what's more important in life. You know what I mean? All the material things you can gain really means nothing if it's lost. You know, at the end of the day, we have each other, and that's what we need to take with this. You know, the lesson of Sandy is really appreciate what you have and live and love and just appreciate life for real.
Indeed. And, you know, one of the great things about music is also, you know, the way it brings people together. And you know, having been a fan of yours for a while and seeing you at shows and various kind of shows that you do, especially the wonderful Stevie Wonder shows out here and other places, that kind of bringing people together is a hallmark of kind of what you do as a DJ. I was wondering if we could just talk, especially for people who may not be as familiar with you, just kind of how you got your start in DJing, how you started up as a DJ.
Well, DJing is kind of like second nature to me. I'm a 70s baby, early 70s, and I witnessed the birth of the DJ, you know, and all of the developments with DJing and the technicalities of it, putting two records together, blending it, listening to early jocks do it on New York City radio, you know, whatever I can experience, DJs outdoors in the park jams in like 78, 77, all that stuff really nurtured my urge to become. I always knew I wanted to be a DJ. You know, as a kid, I was always playing records in my house. My dad had a pretty extensive record collection across the board, from jazz, Latin, soul, you know, everything pretty much. And once I was able to go out and actually physically buy records with allowance money, which was like, you know, early 80s, I was doing that, you know, 45s that were cheaper to get, 12 inches with like $2.99 back in the day, $3.99. Yeah. And basically, professionally, I would say things really started to kick in once I went to college. I went to Binghamton University upstate New York, and doing parties every weekend pretty much paid for my education, paid for my books, paid for my rent, you know, paid my way through school, rocking parties, primarily for the fraternities and sorority, you know, sororities on campus. And I was also able to travel to other schools upstate New York. So once I graduated, I had some connections and started doing local venues in New York, smaller spots, restaurants, making mixtapes of, like, you know, Rare Grooves and soul jazz and stuff like that, and selling those on the side. And of course, while all this is going on, I was also into production. Like, I started going into recording studios in 85. And I had several hip-hop groups that I was a part of producing or learning how to produce anyway. And by 94, 95, I had, you know, recorded a few demos, almost had a record deal with my group Jig Masters, and things fell apart. And then we started the Beyond Real label in 96, and from there, that took off. So between DJing and producing and actually making records, you know, everything kind of coincided for a large part of the 90s, and, you know, pretty much brought me to where I am today. And all the theme parties that I've been doing are a result of, I guess, my fan base, you know, which I would say my fan base is definitely it probably stems more from the music that I've made than actual DJing, because the records have the records that I've done, like the De La Soul remixes, were big overseas, Raucous Era, like all those records really made my name a, you know, it put me on the map. So as a DJ, especially nowadays, you know, as a producer, artist making music, that kind of helps to get the gigs. You know, as a matter of fact, things are so crazy now. I mean, you don't even have to be an experienced DJ, but if you're an artist, a rapper or a singer, you become a DJ automatically, you know, based on having Serato or whatever. But I come from the era where it really was about the talent.
Yeah, and that's actually a couple questions I wanted to get to a little bit later. But while you were talking about, one of the things I was really interested in asking you was just thinking about the different approaches, you know, to being a DJ, and especially the kind of DJ that you are, where you're focused on a lot of parties, a lot of theme parties, that brings in kind of a variety of different sounds, and thinking about production work. And I was wondering, do you feel like that kind of like coming up as more of a kind of party style DJ, how that influences the way that you put beats together and the way you do production?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because essentially, you want your records to get played, you know, especially in a club or in a venue where people are dancing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you want to make music that caters to a good sound system, caters to the dancers. And, you know, I used to dance a little something myself. So all of those things I think about when I'm actually programming a beat or making, you know, putting some music together. Especially, I mean, I'm heavily involved with the deep house community now, you know, especially like as of the early 2000s. So of course that's straight ahead dance floor music.
Yeah.
And I always have that in mind, you know. And even if it's not primarily or specifically for the dance floor, you still want it to knock. You still want it to have a little kick to it. So, you know, EQing. And I engineer most of my stuff, so I always have in mind, you know, how I want my kicks to sound, EQing, snares, bass level, balance of all of the elements to make it sound right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a very specific kind of energy in the work that you do, both the production work and the remix work has, you know, just like you were saying, that it makes good sense that that kind of you have it in mind with either dance floors or dancers, kind of like that kind of vibe to come out.
Right.
Yeah. Is there a different approach between the production work that you do either for other groups and the remix, the kind of process between the two?
Well, it depends on what it is. Obviously, if it's something that I'm going to be releasing on my label or for, you know, something more personal, mm-hmm. that I'm involved with, of course, I'm going to probably have a little more special treatment as far as, like, you know, what I'm actually making. But I put care into everything I do. You know, it's not like I'm going to give somebody a throwaway beat. I don't even consider making throwaway anything. Like, I try to be top-notch quality with everything I do, you know. So as far as approach goes, not really. You know,
okay.
I kind of try to make sure everything is on point.
It seems like there'd be something, you know, it just seems like with remixes, I mean, you're making them for audiences and for DJs to play, but it seems like there's more of a kind of special connection or something when you do like a remix for a Stevie Wonder track or like a Michael Jackson track or something like that.
Well, yeah, obviously you, with those kind of artists, they are classic artists, and you need to... Me personally, I like preserving the natural integrity of those artists,
yeah.
and not bastardizing what they had already done, and trying to stay, you know, kind of true to the original in some form or form. And even if I'm revamping an old song or a new song, actually, I had the opportunity to remix two Stevie Wonder tracks from his last album. And he loved both of them, but one of them I actually had to change. I rephrased the chords, and sometimes old school artists like that, they can't wrap their heads around when you know, take the original song out of its out of context musically, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And he did make a comment to that, you know, but I think it works anyway. A lot of people loved it. It was for a song called My Love Is on Fire. You know, if there's any househeads listening out there, you probably know what it is. You know, and he gave it the thumbs up. He gave it the thumbs up, but it was definitely one of those treading water situations where it was like, okay, you know, if I had gone any further away from the original, he probably would have frowned upon it. So, yeah, when it comes to remixing classic artists, yeah, you gotta, for me, you know, especially growing up with the music and knowing what it meant when it came out and how it impacted people's lives, it's like you want to treat them a certain way, you know. I don't tend to like remixes that just switch things up so much and have heavy programming on something that was originally organic and acoustic or whatever. You know, it really depends. It has to be done tastefully.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the kind of approach, it's kind of a similar approach often Kenny Dope takes to a lot of his remixes, where it's when, as a listener and as a fan of the original, when you flip some things around, it kind of, like, it makes you appreciate the original just as much as the remix.
Right. Well, speaking of Kenny, he and I are really close friends, and I credit him and even Louis Vega, Masters at Work, as being probably my biggest influences when it comes to remixing, because even before I met them, when I was doing those college parties that I mentioned before, I was buying all their records and studying them. And, you know, the remix game was so big when they really started hitting the pavement in, you know, 90, 91, 92. And once I actually got in the studio with them and saw how they worked and saw what they actually were doing to get these turn these remixes around, it made me realize that that's where the integrity thing kicks in. It's like you have to understand the music, understand what it's about, what it means, what the purpose of it was originally, and just flip it enough where it translates well to the dance floor, but you're not taking away from it. You know, they're probably to me the best ever to have entered the whole remix game. Like, they're the best, in my opinion.
Now, earlier you were talking a little bit about kind of changes in technology and how that's affected DJing, and I had kind of a series of questions kind of connected to that, and especially kind of the influence of Serato. And there have been times where I've seen you DJ and you're using Serato. Today you actually brought all records, which I'm super excited to see you just spin on vinyl, and suddenly wish this wasn't radio and it was TV so all y'all could see it too. But I was wondering, just kind of on a personal level, just how the influence of this kind of specific technology in Serato, how that's affected you as a DJ.
Wow, I'm kind of glad you brought this up. You know, I've been rocking Serato since 2005, and it came out of utter frustration of years of traveling with crates, heavy metal crates at that. And over time, the airlines either charging you an arm and a leg, because it really changed drastically during the course of me starting to travel. Like, you know, over a span of maybe 3 years, they started hitting you in the head extensively for overweight charges. So between that and, you know, almost losing records on a flight, you know, getting off the plane, going to your baggage claim, and your records don't show up, and you start freaking out. You're wondering if they were jacked or they were stolen or what. And then I think one particular situation, the records didn't make the flight and they were coming in later and my gig was the same night. So, you know, all kinds of, so, you know, Serato for me was sort of like a graduation and a lifesaver, so to speak. But from a record collector, record loving, record junkie perspective, I still love vinyl, still buy vinyl, always on the hunt for vinyl, still love the way it feels, still, you know, I still feel like it's the best sounding warmth form. It's the way music was supposed to be heard, because that's, you know, going back to the early years of recording, the recording industry and records, you know, who would have thought that one day music would just exist in numbers?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And not in a physical format. So, you know, there's perks to digital, but analog for me is still number one. It's just very cumbersome and a hassle to travel with. But with all this being said, over the last few years, what's been happening to me is I've gotten so much music into my computer that it's hard to keep track now of what I have. And after years of, you know, DJing and looking at records and being able to identify what you're going to play by labels and jackets, sometimes I wouldn't even know the name of an artist on some random record or name of a song. But if you going through your crates and you pick up the record, you kind of know, you just know what it is. You know, you pull the record out, you know where to go to on the vinyl.
Yeah.
You know, I read grooves so you can see where the breaks are. And in Serato, it kind of gets, you know, it's lost information at times. You know, I find myself blanking out, not remembering certain titles and trying to remember one word in a title and having to search my entire computer just to find one song in the middle of a mix.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I wouldn't get the song up in time and have to throw something else. So just all kinds of things that have been happening, like mental blocks with DJing in my laptop. And, you know, it could be a problematic thing, you know, coming from vinyl. It's still convenient, especially when I'm doing gigs where I'm constantly moving around. You know, I have to do one city, jump on a plane, do another city, jump on a plane. You know, those kinds of things. Serato comes in very handy. But, you know, as of late, for example, I'm in L.A. to do the Funky Soul Party with Miles, and that's an all-vinyl party. So for me, it's like, great, I could bring all these records out and, you know, kind of revisit my passion for carrying records and playing records out. And the other problem too that I experienced is a lot of these venues all over the world don't care about turntable maintenance and the technical aspects of playing vinyl in a club when it comes to feedback and noise and all kinds of stuff. Like, everybody's digital everywhere, so when someone actually does bring records out to a club, it's like, you know, the troubleshooting is at zero. Like, they don't even know what to do and how to defeat the feedback situation. You still get the hum and it's all kinds of stuff, man. So, you know, and turntables are beat up all over the place, man. Like, everybody has CDJs and automatic Serato connections and all kinds of stuff, man. But it's, you know, you got to move with the time. I figured it's either do that or be left in the dust. Because the other issue is a lot of music doesn't even come out on vinyl. That's the other problem. You know what I'm saying? If you want to, if you're trying to stay current and stay relevant in certain genres, you don't want to miss out. You kind of have to go the digital route, whether you're playing CDs or playing in your laptop, or you miss it. You miss music. You know, and I like collecting everything. You know what I mean? So, whatever I can't get on vinyl, I'll definitely try to get it digitally just to have it and play it.
That in some ways it kind of connects to a larger question kind of connected to Serato. Like, how do you feel that Serato is affecting DJ culture at large?
Well, I don't appreciate the fact that everyone can just buy the kit and become and call themselves a DJ automatically, not knowing what DJing actually entails. Because I'm not trying to put a, you know, a super old age on myself, but I come from the old school. I've been going to clubs before I was able to really technically get into clubs. You know what I'm saying? I've been going to roller skating rinks, and I learned from watching the best of the best do it. And nowadays, you know, between people that are going out, especially the younger generation that never really experienced true great sound in a club and true dance floor journeys and epic situations, their attention spans are very short.
Yeah.
They don't know what it's like. Like, even for myself lately, what I've been doing is playing whole songs out. you know, on stuff that the average quote unquote hip hop DJ might cut up the break of it and, you know, a verse and a chorus and out of it, in and out real quick. I'll play the whole song, because what I'm trying to do now is re-educate the dance floor on what it means to experience a full length song. Like, for example, I do this party called What the Funk, which is with my brother Rich Medina from mm-hmm. Philly, which is a James Brown versus Fela mm-hmm. party. And you know what I've been doing, you know, like last night I just did it in San Francisco, and I played Super Bad from beginning to end, the whole 9 minutes.
Wow.
And there's so many peaks and valleys in that song. It intensifies. You know, you don't want to cut that off. You know what I'm saying? Like some records, yeah, Funky Drummer. You know, some records, yeah, you got to cut it up and get in and out of it. But other records, it's like, man, let it play, let it breathe. So, you know, and even with the wonderful parties, like a lot of these events that I do, I'm really just trying to preserve the music. Mm-hmm. So going back to your question about the overnight DJ sensation, it's a travesty, because I feel like you have to go to school to be a DJ. And I don't mean that literally. I mean DJ school in the sense of really learning and understanding what it's about. You know, maybe my philosophy is getting old and it's a lost art form because you know, you have all these ravers and, you know, a lot of DJs and partygoers with other genres of music, you know, lengthy sets, but the songs are like repetitive, and it's, you know, there's no peaks and valleys in the music. It's mm-hmm. there's no story. So, you know, people's attention spans, people's mindsets are not really geared for music, real music. It's very, you know, digital. It's very technical. It's very, you know, it's kind of cookie cutter.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah. Do you feel like that? Because, I mean, in some respects, you know, you look at differences in popular music over the years, and you see some of those same kind of trends. I mean, you know, popular music in the 30s and 40s was kind of like that, in addition to the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. But there do seem to be, depending on the genre, kind of different conventions and different expectations. And especially with the kind of stuff that you do and kind of with not necessarily the way people generally define hip hop, but kind of the like old school approach of a hip hop DJ, where there is this possibility of hearing all variety of sounds kind of into this mix. Like, do you feel like some of the kind of digitization of things has really affected audiences as much as it's affected
absolutely.
DJs?
Absolutely, because we're in that age of technology constantly expanding, and you know, the way people consume music now is in an iPod and mm-hmm. in their iPads and in their iPhones, and of course that's going to affect how they experience music in a social light, because it may not necessarily mean going to a club with a crazy sound system and hearing your favorite, you know, everybody for the most part when they go out in the popular sense, popular culture, they want to hear what they already know. Mm-hmm. They want to hear what's top 40. And it's very rare where you get a crowd that is just open-minded and, you know, you can break. I mean, I was DJing in New York at a time where you felt the transition between the mid-90s to the early 2000s. You noticed people coming into the club and just requesting all of a sudden the same records that they heard mm-hmm. on the radio or saw the videos of, you know, mm-hmm. and it's been like that ever since. It hasn't changed for the most part, you know. So I removed myself from that world. I can do it if I really had to, but yeah. I prefer not to, just so that I can stretch out a little bit. And it's a difference. It's a major difference. Yeah. You know, it's crazy, but that's just what it is. It's the sign of the times.
It is interesting. I mean, you were talking about Rich Medina, and I know earlier this year he had a incident here in L.A. at the do-over, which is generally thought of and kind of seen as one of those spots that, you know, DJs can literally play whatever, you know, and the crowd is right there with them. But he had a little situation with somebody who was requesting something and didn't like his response.
Yes, I heard about that.
Yeah.
I heard about
that. It does strike me that that doesn't seem like the kind of thing that you would expect to happen at a spot like that, or especially with a DJ like Rich Medina. And it really does seem to be very much connected to, I don't know exactly how to describe.
Well, almost it's popular like a, culture now.
Yeah, almost kind of like an entitlement kind of like feeling with audiences because of the digital stuff. As a DJ, you should be able to play whatever they want you to play at that moment because of the technology.
Here's my thing with that. You know, the person who was making this request obviously, most likely, did not know what the do-over was about. Probably went there because they heard it's the happening thing to go to, and probably never went to the do-over when it was at the other location, mm-hmm. the smaller location. And, you know, they're part of the Matrix, you know what I'm saying? And it's like they just got caught up in their moment where they want to hear what they want to hear, because whatever it was probably top 40 at the time, and Rich was not having it. So, you know, that's exactly what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, as he should not have had to experience something like that at a party like that. And unfortunately, we get those, you know? It happens.
Hmm. I'm wondering what's coming up next for you. I know that, you know, it always seems like you have a lot of different projects, either kind of smaller remix projects or even something larger, or just like the collection that you worked with Barely Breaking Even earlier in the year with
Perception
Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, very happy to see that, and that it was such an expansive set. So many things I had never seen before from Perception Records, and I'm just wondering kind of what else is going on with you.
Wow, I have seeds spread out all over the place right now. You know, the most immediate thing you probably see is I just did something for Sadat X's new album, which is coming out soon. I think by the end of this month, it'll be out. It's a song called Love, Hell, or Right. It's the title track. I got a new label called Correct Technique, geared mostly towards my brand of hip-hop, putting out primarily 45s at the moment.
Mm.
And the next one will be with Shabam Sadiq. And shortly after that, I'm trying to, believe it or not, get a Jigmasters EP out, top of the year.
Cool.
My intention is to make a four-pack 45 vinyl set and a digital EP. So that's immediate. And then, you know, hopefully in the course of next year, what I'd like to do is another intergalactic soul or galactic soul-ish album.
Okay.
Featuring various artists. I think I'm definitely overdue for one of those, because the last one came out like, I want to say it was like, 2007 or something like that, 2005 or something like that. So definitely overdue. And then, you know, besides those things, just random remixes here and there, especially in the house world. The house world has got me going right now, man. I just, the reason why I love that genre so much is because it's immediate response. Like you put a joint out, and you give it to a few DJs, they'll play it, it'll chart where it needs to chart, and I get my reaction from the dance floor instantly. It's instantaneous, whereas with other genres, especially with hip hop, there's more politics involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the outlets for them are very limited.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to like radio, and, you know, no one's really playing a lot of these great hip hop records that have come out in venues anymore. You know, mm-hmm. you don't really hear it, you know, that much. So the game has changed, you know. But I still love it. You know, it's still part of me, so I'm still gonna do that too.
Yeah. Do you think you're going to do any more kind of collections like this Perception thing?
Well, actually, I'm working on a another, what was the name of that? Boogie Back.
Okay.
For BBE, which is, you know, another compilation of rare post-disco boogie tracks. Nice. You know, early 80s, late 70s, early 80s dance floor records. I'm working on that right now. It's just it's taking a little time to get clearances on some of the stuff, but, you know, that's being worked on as we speak.
Okay.
You know, still working on clearing some stuff.
Okay. You know, there's so many different things I could chat with you about. You know, I really do sincerely hope at some point you'll be able to come back in and we can cut things back up again. But we also have you here to spin some records for us.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want to miss that, too. So just coming up in a bit, we're going to play a couple messages here at the top of the hour, and then Spinner is going to come back and play you a bunch of records, mostly looks like off of 45 vinyl. So that is coming up right here for you, and thanks once again, man, for coming in. So
thank you
so much.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so stay tuned, still have more Spinner guest DJ set from DJ Spinner coming up right here in just a bit on KPFK and Melting Pot.